You can take Hollywood for granted like I did, or you can dismiss it with the contempt we reserve for what we don't understand. It can be understood too, but only dimly and in flashes.
Hooray for Hollywood, that screwy ballyhooey Hollywood, where any office boy or young mechanic can be a panic with just a good looking pan. And any barmaid can be a star maid if she dances with or without a fan. Hooray for Hollywood, where you're terrific if you're even good, where anyone at all from TV's Lassie to Monroe's Chassie is equally understood. Go out and try your luck, you might be Donald Duck. Hooray for Hollywood.
More than anything else in the world, he wanted to make pictures. It seemed to him infinitely romantic.
Hooray for Hollywood, that phony super coney Hollywood. They come from Chillicothe and Paducah with their bazookas to get their names up in lights. All armed with photos from local rodos, with their hair in ribbons and legs in tights. Hooray for Hollywood. Be homely in your neighborhood, but if you think that you can be an actor, see Mr. Factor. He'd make a monkey look good. Within a half an hour, you'll look like Tyrone Power. Hooray for Hollywood.
Hollywood has always been a cage to catch our dreams. We make pictures, we put frames around them, and we start all over again, somewhere, anywhere. The lion roars, and the searchlights pierce the heavens. A mountain of dreams, a world revolves, and a shield of honor. The symbols of power, the image makers. A cautionary tale of old Hollywood and its stars. Ghettos of Kiev and Minsk spawned them, and early starvation seemed their only future. But they survived, and became survivors in the ghettos of Warsaw and the little forgotten towns of Germany, Hungary, and Poland. And when the time was propitious, which meant as soon as they possibly could, they migrated to the promised land, to turn-of-the-century America, where they became absorbed in the giant melting pot working at menial tasks wherever a buck was to be found and hard won. As junk dealers, as glove salesmen, as cloth spongers, as pool hustlers, and a ratty-tatty furrier. And they prospered. And as they prospered, they changed their names, names more suited to their new prosperity. Names like Mayer, Goldwyn, Warner, Zucker, Zanuck, and Selznick. One by one, they found themselves drawn to and fascinated by the entertainment world. First, to what was called Nickelodeons, where for a small coin you could see a saucy peep show, a series of still photographs revolving in sequence on a drum, whilst having your fortune told along with your weight. And then came an extraordinary new invention, a miracle to these dregs of the European ghettos, a new medium called motion pictures. They invested their money in the new miracle, a daring thing to do in a medium which was already being looked down upon by organized religion as being something suspiciously like the work of the devil. Besides which, it was claimed that the device was likely to give a permanent squint to the viewer, as well as arousing lust in the mind of man, with its inevitable result, the debauchery of young girls. Despite the dire warnings from world pulpits, the public flocked to the movies, devoured them, and were devoured by them. The junk dealers and the clothes sponges and the furriers founded empires of unimaginable wealth and power they called studios. And firmly ensconced in the seat of power, they ruled their studios as much as any king with his kingdom. In the golden age of Greece, gods and goddesses disguised themselves as mortals and roamed the face of the earth. In the golden age of Hollywood, mortals disguised themselves as gods and never left MGM or Paramount or 20th Century Fox or Warners. They were the image makers: Zanuck, Mayer, Warner, Zucker, Limmerly, Cohn, Goldwyn, and David O. Selznick. They created Hollywood's golden age. With the death of Daryl F. Zanuck just a few weeks ago, the light went out on the last of the movie moguls. The great pioneers have now gone, but their extraordinary achievements remain, enshrined forever on narrow strips of acetate, which the world calls the movies. It began 68 years ago, this coming June 8th. In 1912, Carl Limmerly, who died in 1939, founded the Universal Film Manufacturing Company, now known as Universal Studios, the oldest and largest film studio in the world. Limmerly is often credited with launching the star system by hiring Florence Lawrence for $1,000 a week and identifying her by name, an unknown policy at the time. Because of the success of this practice and because of his own independent policies, Limmerly came into considerable conflict with the Motion Pictures Patents Company, which was basically a monopoly formed by most of the major studios. After years of fighting the Patents Company, Limmerly moved Universal to Hollywood, where he could be closer to the Mexican border to avoid prosecution for infringement of patent rights. In 1915, Universal acquired its present site, Universal City, then a chicken farm, which Limmerly purchased for a down payment of $3,500. The first incorporated city to consist solely of a film studio. Although Universal always was a major studio, most of its silent films are not recalled as being among the classics. But as in later years, the horror films remained in filmgoers' minds. In the 1920s, it was Lon Chaney who dominated that particular genre with his Hunchback of Notre Dame and The Phantom of the Opera. With the advent of sound, the studio quickly adapted to the new format, winning an Oscar, its first, for the best picture of the year, 1930s anti-war film, All Quiet on the Western Front. Paradoxically, the success of that film was the start of a downward slide into the red, and by 1936, the stockholders had had enough. They forced out Limmerly and his regime, and the new Universal began, with the resounding success of a film called Three Smart Girls, which began its production life as a B film and ended up as a modestly budgeted A. The result was that the film's 15-year-old Deanna Durbin became a star, and Universal jumped out of the red into the black for the first time in years. Never again was Universal to produce a homegrown star of such magnitude, although Deanna Durbin today is in danger of becoming a lost star. Her films are almost never revived and almost never seen on television, reportedly because of legal restrictions and entanglements. Durbin herself, living in retirement these past 25 years on the outskirts of Paris, refuses to be interviewed, photographed, or even talked by telephone with those responsible for her film success. Deanna Durbin from the soundtrack of First Love with Spring in My Heart. During the 40s, the studio pinned its faith in Technicolor and outrageous costume romps with Maria Montez and John Hall, the comedy of Bud Abbott and Lou Costello, and the prestigious classic films from England's J. Arthur Rank. In the 50s, the giant music corporation of America became the new owners of Universal. And for the next decade or so, the studio's great white hope was Ross Hunter, who was responsible for the money-making melodramas such as Imitation of Life and Written on the Wind, as well as the Doris Day Rock Hudson comedies. During the mid-60s, the studio concentrated on television, producing the first made-for-television movie in 1966, Fame is the Name of the Game. Today, Universal is the leading Hollywood studio in the field of television and is also famous for its conducted tours of the studio, which is among the most powerful and wealthiest in Hollywood, thanks to the release of such blockbusters as the most profitable movie ever made, Jaws. 1917, Harry, Jack, Albert, and Sam Warner established a film distribution company in New York. 5 years later, they expanded into film production as well, forming Warner Brothers Pictures Incorporated. Harry, the company's president, and Albert, its treasurer, managed the New York headquarters, while Jack and Sam ran the studio in Hollywood. Jack Warner was the most powerful of the four, running the studio under tight economic policies. Although the studio acquired the Vitagraph Company in 1925, Warner Brothers' first years were nevertheless shaky. Its first great success did not come until the studio's introduction of sound in 1927.
Ladies and gentlemen, I am privileged to say a few words to you in this most modern and novel manner. Privileged because it's the first living Vitaphone announcement ever made announcing the coming of one of the year's outstanding pictures. What is the picture? Well, of course, you've guessed that I'm referring to Warner Brothers' supreme triumph, Al Jolson in The Jazz Singer. Now, you are not only going to have the opportunity of seeing Mr. Jolson, but through this marvelous invention, Vitaphone, you are also going to be able to hear him talk as well as sing. And, oh, mamma, how that bird can warble. And now I'm not going to take up any more of your time. Good night.
Blue jays, they say, all of them gone. Nothing but blue skies from now on. You like that, Mama?
Yes.
I'm glad of it. I'd rather please you than anybody I know of. Mama, darling, if I'm a success in this show, well, we're going to move from here. Oh, yes, we're going to move up in the Bronx. A lot of nice green grass up there and a whole lot of people you know. There's the Ginsbergs, the Guttenbergs, and the Goldbergs. Oh, a whole lot of birds. I don't know them all. And I'm going to buy you a nice black silk dress, Mama. You see, Mrs. Friedman, the butcher's wife, she'll be jealous of you.
Oh, no.
Yes, she will. You see if she isn't. And I'm going to get you a nice pink dress that'll go with your brown eyes. What do you mean, no? Who is telling you? What do you mean, no? Yes, you'll wear pink or else. Or else you'll wear pink. And, darling, Mama, listen, I'm going to sing this like I will if I go on the stage, you know, with this show. I'm going to sing it jazzy. Now, get this. Blue sky, smiling at me, 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 me. Nothing but little blue sky, do I see. Do, 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 do. Blue bird, singing a song. Nothing but little blue bird, all day long. You like that slap, don't you?
Mammy, my little Mammy, the sun shines east, the sun shines west, but I know where the sun shines best. It's on my Mammy I'm talking about, nobody else's. My little Mammy, my heartstrings are tangled around Alabama.
Mammy, I'm coming. I hope I didn't make you wait. Mammy, I'm coming. Oh, God, I hope I'm not late. Mammy, don't you know me? It's your little baby. I'd walk a million miles, a one of your smiles, on my mammy.
Al Jolson in the talking sensation of 1927, the jazz singer from the Warner Brothers. With Western Electric and Bell Laboratories, Sam Warner had invented the sound process Vitaphone. Sam died the day before the jazz singer opened, never knowing what a revolution he'd helped bring about in films. Almost overnight, Warner's rose to preeminence in Hollywood because of its early sound films. During the 30s and the 40s, Warner's excelled in four types of films. Gangster movies, like Little Caesar and Public Enemy, the Busby Berkeley musicals, the Gold Digger series and 42nd Street, social conscience films, like I Am a Fugitive from a Chain Gang and Confessions of a Nazi Spy, and biographies of famous people like Zola, Pasteur, and Reuter. During these decades, Warner's contract players included Humphrey Bogart, James Cagney, Edward G. Robinson, Errol Flynn, Paul Muni, Olivia de Havilland, and the greatest of them all, the one whom all of Hollywood often referred to as the fifth Warner Brother, Miss Betty Davis.
I wish you'd tell me what it is.
Why didn't you marry Livingston? I tell you why. Because I came along and ruined him for you. And now my child comes along and claims all your attention and takes your whole life when you should be trying to find some man who'll make you happy.
Some man who'll make me happy. So that's it. Well, I've certainly made a great mistake. Here I have been laboring under the delusion that you and I were so in sympathy, so one, that you'd know without being asked what would make me happy. And you come up here to talk about some man. Apparently you haven't the slightest conception of what torture it is to love a man and to be shut out, barred out, to be always an outsider and an extra.
Charlotte, let me...
Why, when Tina said she wanted to come home and stay with me, well, it was like a miracle happening. Like having your child, a part of you. And I even allowed myself to indulge in the fancy that both of us loving her and doing what was best for her together would make her seem actually like our child after a while. But I see no such fancy has occurred to you. Again, I've been just a big sentimental fool. It's a tendency I have.
Wait a minute. I was afraid you were keeping Tina out of pity. But there was no note of pity in your ridicule of me just now. Now I know you still love me, and it won't die what's between us. Do what we will. Ignore it. Neglect it. Starve it. Stronger than both of us together.
Please let me go.
Charlotte.
Please let me go.
Just have a cigarette on it?
Yes. You like. It's your home, too. There are people here who love you.
They look at you and Tina and share with you peace and contentment.
Of course. And just think it won't be for this time only. That is, if you will help me keep what we have. We both try hard to protect that little strip of territory that's ours. We can talk about your child.
Our child. Will you be happy, Charlotte?
Oh, Jerry, don't let's ask for the moon. We have the stars.
Betty Davis and Paul Henreid in 1942's Now Voyager from the Warner Brothers. After unsuccessful ventures into the widescreen process in the early 50s, Jack Warner lost some control of the studio. During the latter part of the decade, the company invested heavily in television series with some degree of success. Since then, the studio has dealt largely with independent producers for its feature films. Hence, the studio's releases during the 60s were more variable than they'd previously been, ranging from large-scale productions like My Fair Lady, Camelot, and The Great Race, to risky films like Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf and Bonnie and Clyde. In 1967, Warner Brothers merged with the television company Seven Arts, and in 1969 was acquired by the conglomerate Kinney National Service. At that time, Jack Warner retired from the board and died on September 9, 1978. During recent years, the studio has maintained an impressive output of influential films, not the least of which was one of the first of the disaster epics, and still one of the best, The Towering Inferno. John Williams' main title music for The Towering Inferno from the Warner Brothers. If one film symbolizes Hollywood of the Golden Age, then it would have to be Gone with the Wind. Decades after its brilliant star-drenched premiere in Atlanta, audiences were still flocking to see reruns of the epic story of Scarlett O'Hara and Rhett Butler played out against the background of a bloody civil war. Gone with the Wind was the supreme achievement of its producer David O. Selznick, a movie maker of prodigious energy and ambition, then at the very height of his powers. A man whose vision of the world was an infinitely more romantic place than audiences everywhere had ever known. The photographic splendor of his films was but one trademark of a Hollywood producer whose classic films and legendary stars helped create Hollywood's most glorious era, Henry Fonda.
The glamour of the first all-star casts and unique personalities like Marie Dressler and Jean Harlow.
I was reading a book the other day.
Reading a book?
Yes, it's all about civilization or something. A nutty kind of a book. Do you know that the guy says that machinery is going to take the place of every profession?
Oh, my dear. That's something you need never worry about.
I knew where Rebecca's body was. Lying on that cabin floor on the bottom of the sea.
How did you know, Max?
Because I put it there.
Laurence Olivier and Joan Fontaine and Rebecca. It's the era of the star system and superstars of colorful individuality. Wallace Beery is Pancho Villa.
Cut him down.
Your hair.
Catherine Hepburn in Little Women.
Oh, well, Almont croaked as she always does when Oscar ninepence and Mommy, she only sent you just money enough for the ticket, and I knew you'd need more, and so, well, I happened to be going past a barber shop, and I saw some tails of hair hanging in the window with the prices marked on them, and so I thought it'd do my brain good to have my mop cut off, and so I did.
Gentlemen of the Academy and fellow suckers, I got one of those once for a best performance. They don't mean a thing.
A star is born.
What I want's a special award.
Frederick March mortifies Janet Gaynor.
I want a statue for the worst performance of the year. What I'm here to find out is, do I get them or do I get them? I'll answer yes or no.
Selznick's life's accomplishment was remarkable. No other producer functioned on so many levels. His contributions to films lay in the meaning and importance he gave to the role of the creative producer, a task requiring the maximum know-how, intelligence, and taste. Alfred Hitchcock.
Selznick belonged to the school of real picture makers, of which there are very few today.
If I were Dorothy McGuire. Use a single word talking about David, I think I would use the word giant. He was a man with outsized taste, outsized ideas and visions.
He had an innate King sense Vidor. Of what a film should be and what people, what the American people and the people of the world were like.
He was full of George energy. George Cukor. And he had enormous zest and appetite for work and for a living.
He left.
Alan Pakula.
He even smoked too much. He never stopped smoking. He never had a cigarette out of his mouth. There was always cigarette burns down his shirt. We used to kid him about it. He'd laugh hard.
He thoroughly believed in treating his actors like little tin gods. I think, though, he was a little hard on directors.
I think Hitchcock
Ingrid
is
Bergman.
One of the few directors who really could stand up to him. And Selznick did leave him alone, and he had... they were two strong men, and they had great respect for each other.
But on the other hand, they tell me, although I never experienced this, that he could be very ruthless. Maybe one should sum it up by saying he was charmingly ruthless.
At the age of 24, in the face of a hostile Hollywood who hated his father, David O. Selznick walked through the gates of MGM, hired on a two-week trial basis at $100 a week. Within 6 months, it was $3,000 a week. David O. Selznick.
Hollywood was a village in those days. It was a village of youth
Anyone over the age of 30 was considered an old man. I was running RKO when I was 28. Was an industry abuse. They were the great pioneering days, the great frontier days. Everything was a first. And even when sound came in, everything became new all over again. The first Western with sound, the first war picture with sound. And we were all pioneers. Everything we did had never been done before.
Bird of Paradise with Joel McRae, Selznick is among the first to use music under dialogue. Up to this time, producers feared audiences would wonder where the music came from. The bird of the title is Dolores del Rio.
I thought I just had a yen for you. I thought this was only going to be a lark. Oh, but I love you, Luana. I love you more than I've ever loved anyone. More than I ever could love anyone.
Thank you very much, John.
King Kong, of which Selznick is the executive producer, will become the father of not only the Son of Kong, but of countless other monster movies. In 1933, Selznick is Hollywood's fair-haired boy. The son of one great movie pioneer, Louis J. Selznick, his wife's the daughter of another, Louis B. Mayer of MGM. When Selznick sets up his own production unit at Mayer's studio, it causes much comment. Director George Cukor.
There were articles appeared in some of the trade papers that annoyed David Selznick. Well, the snide articles annoyed him very much. They said, the son-in-law also rises, as though David Selznick had been engaged by Mayer because he was his son-in-law. In fact, I don't think Mayer was all that happy when his daughter married David Selznick, not because he didn't think he was a young man of good character, a great future, but I think David was not docile enough, and Mr. Mayer had a very strong will. They got on very, very well professionally and otherwise, and they ended up as being very loving friends.
David represented something far more sophisticated than much of that era.
Producer Alan Pakula.
He represented the best of it and the most outrageous and the most romantic of it. And in that way, I would say he was the essence of the Hollywood legend.
The essence of the Hollywood legend. David O. Selznick, at 28, production head of RKO. At 31, chief of his own production unit at MGM, at a weekly salary of $4,000, and the pick of MGM's star roster at his call. At 33, he formed Selznick International Pictures, his own production company, and the new company's first picture was a version of Francis Hodgson Burnett's celebrated tale, Little Lord Fauntleroy, the start of an ambitious schedule of quality films that was to culminate in the most ambitious project of all. For this, a veritable avalanche of publicity emanated from the Selznick publicists on this most celebrated of all American Civil War novels. And nearly every established star and starlet in Hollywood was willing, eager, and oft-times bid test for the much sought-after lead. Henry Fonda continues.
Meanwhile, Selznick proceeds with plans for the most ambitious filmmaking venture in history. By special arrangement with MGM, Clark Gable is borrowed to play Rhett Butler. But on the eve of production, Selznick still has no Scarlett.
And so the day came, however.
Selznick's publicist, Russell Birdwell.
When we had to start the picture because of our commitment with MGM for the services of Clark Gable. And so we all assembled on the back lot of Selznick International to watch the burning of Atlanta. And during the height of the fire, David's brother, Myron Selznick, an agent and a very illustrious one, showed up. And with him, there was a woman. And Myron kept tugging at David's coattails, saying, David, David, I have brought to you Scarlett O'Hara, and I want you to meet her. David kept trying to hush him, saying, shh, shh, Myron. I mean, the cameras are turning.
Myron said, I don't care about the cameras turning. You don't have a Scarlett O'Hara, and I brought it. And Myron to try to drive home his point that he didn't have a selfish or an ulterior interest kept saying to David, but David, this girl isn't even a client of mine. This is Scarlett O'Hara.
Miss Vivian Leigh!
With an English girl as Scarlett, in December 1939, Gone with the Wind's ready for the waiting public.
The one and only Rhett Butler, Mr. Clark Gable. Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Ladies and gentlemen, tonight I am here just as a spectator. I want to see Gone with the Wind the same as you. This is Margaret Mitchell's night and the people of Atlanta's night. Thank you.
And may I present at this time Mr. David O. Selznick.
3 years of effort have led to this moment. If Atlanta, which is the final judge, approves our efforts, these labors will not have been in vain.
David O. Selznick died in 1965. He died a much-loved legend. He once said, "Nothing in Hollywood is permanent. Once photographed, life here is ended." He had photographed it in A Tale of Two Cities, David Copperfield, Dinner at Eight, Rebecca, Gone with the Wind. David O. Selznick left behind the films. MGM and its famous emblem, Leo the Lion. Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer had its origins in Marcus Lowe, a shrewd pioneer during the Nickelodeon era. Originally, his interest was in the exhibition of motion pictures, continually expanding his theater empire to include eventually production. When in 1920, Lowe, with his associate Nicholas Schenck, acquired Metro Picture Corporation. Encouraged by the success of two of their first productions, The Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse and The Prisoner of Zender, they purchased the Goldwyn Company in 1924, and later that same year acquired the assets of Louis B. Mayer, becoming Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer. Under the conservative economic policies of Nicholas Schenck in New York, the dominant force of Mayer as studio head in Hollywood, and the creative ideas of Irving Thalberg as executive producer, MGM developed through the late 20s to become the most successful studio of the 30s. With its proud boast of more stars than there are in the heavens, MGM had under contract such luminaries as Joan Crawford, Clark Gable, Gene Harlow, the Barrymores, the Marx Brothers, and Garbo.
Marguerite Gautier.
You wrote me an unkind letter.
What did you expect? I saw the Baron's carriage.
You were jealous.
Of course.
Well, then, you'd do right in going away.
Oh, what does it matter whether I go or stay? Played the fool again, and you've probably been laughing at me ever since.
I didn't laugh at all. I was angry because you dared write such things to me, but I didn't love.
You should have known it was because I loved you.
You remember once I had a little dog, and he always looked sad when I was sad, and I loved him so. And when your tears fell on my hand, I loved you too all at once. Oh, there are things that you wouldn't understand, so that's why. Who's that pretty girl?
My sister Louise.
Oh. And the other one?
Another sister.
And that's your mother, isn't it?
Yes.
How happy she looks. Does your father love her very much?
Of course.
Why, they must have been married a long time.
Nearly 30 years.
And they loved each other all the time?
Yes, you... You sound as though you didn't believe it.
It's hard to believe that there's such happiness in this world.
Marguerite, now you've put tears on my hand. Why?
You will never love me 30 years. No one will.
I love you all my life. I know that now. All my life.
I've loved you as much as I could love. If that wasn't enough, I'm not to blame. We don't make our own hearts.
Yes, that's true. You're no more to blame because yours can be faithful only a few weeks than I am, because mine will be faithful as long as I live.
Yes, that's how it is.
It's as if one was to die, Marguerite, suddenly. I dreamed it. Where are you going?
Baron de Varville is expecting me.
Robert Taylor, with Garbo as Marguerite Gauthier in Camille, from MGM in 1937. MGM was making 40 to 50 films a year, and in 1937 its profits were $14 million, a record no other studio could then equal. And it was in its musicals that MGM excelled. When the studio's musical glories from the past were pasted together a few years ago in a compilation fittingly called That's Entertainment, the studio called upon Frank Sinatra to play host, and he proceeded to get the picture underway with such panache that it stays in the memory as much as any of the MGM musicals he hosted.
I'm singing in the rain, just singing in the rain. All the glory is stealing, I'm happy again.
The year is 1929. The singer Cliff Edwards, also known as Ukulele Ike. The film Hollywood Review. It is the first all-talking, all-singing, all-dancing movie ever made.
Everyone from the place, come on with your rain. I've got a smile on my face. I'll walk down the line.
In the years that followed, Singing in the Rain would become a theme song for MGM.
Singing in the rain.
Yeah, yeah, da-da-da-da.
In the 1930s, Jimmy Durante gave us this rendition.
You wrote that this morning?
Yeah. It's something they remember.
Yeah, I remember it already.
I'm singing in the rain. Oh, I'm singing in the rain. What a grand, what a glorious feeling. I'm happy again.
In the 1940s, Judy Garland did it her way.
Dark up above, sun in my heart. I'm getting ready for love. Stormy clouds chase everyone from the place. And come on with the rain. I've a smile on my face. I walk down the lane with a happy refrain. And
in the 1950s, Gene Kelly, Debbie Reynolds, and Donald O'Connor put it all together in what many folks would call the best musical ever made.
Singing in the rain, just singing in the rain. What a glorious feeling, we're happy again. We'll
if you're wondering what happened in between, well, sit back and relax. You're about to find out.
The beginning of That's Entertainment and the history of MGM. The studio continued its success in the early 40s, but the old guard was aging. Mayer brought Dori Shirey into the studio to head production, and the two soon found themselves at odds. Antagonism between the two became so strong that in 1951, Louis B. Mayer resigned and Schenck appointed Shirey as studio head. But the all-powerful Schenck was unable to fight MGM's two major problems in the 50s, television and the antitrust actions brought by the U.S. government that forced the studio to divorce its production distribution interests from its exhibition facilities. MGM started to decline, and in 1956, both Shirey and Schenck lost their positions at the studio. Under Joseph M. Vogel, MGM spent $15 million on Ben-Hur, which paid back its investment handsomely. But the studio's $27 million remake of Mutiny was financially disastrous. In 1963, the studio lost $17 million. In that year, Robert O'Brien took over MGM, allowing the studio to invest $12 million in Dr. Zhivago, which made more money for the studio than any other film in its history, except Gone with the Wind, which was really a David O. Selznick production, and which MGM distributed in exchange for Clark Gable. But the studio began to suffer declines again, losing a whopping $35 million in 1969 alone. And in an attempt to offset the losses, MGM changed management three times in 10 months. In 1969, Kirk Kerkorian took power, and within the next few years reduced the studio's film production and auctioned off its history, its sets, its lots, its costumes, and its props.
Two boats are coming. All right, what's your bid to start? 500 on bid. 1,000 on bid. 2,000 on bid. 3, 4, 5,000. 7,500 on bid and go to 10. 8,000 on bid. 9,000 behind Maxie, thank you. Give me a 10 now. 11,500, go ahead. 12,500 your way. 15, maybe. 12,500 on bid, go to 15 one time. 15,000. Last call. Sold for $15,000. Congratulations.
Yeah. Oh, I've had enough of this bloodshed. Now you give me your last command on this ship. We'll be men again if we hang for it. Are you ready for anything?
Aye.
Erase those men.
We're with it.
Oh, ask mutiny. Pass the word. Seize the arm.
You're sending me to my doom, eh? Well, you're wrong, Christian. I'll take this boat as she floats to England if I must. I'll live to see you, all of you, hanging from the highest yardarm in the British fleet.
All right, now, yes, now we got mutiny on the Bounty here. How much for, what are we here for? $50 bid, $75 here, $100 bid a half, the one and a quarter, $125, one and a half, $75, would you go to? $200 bid, $250 bid. Are you wound down to $250? Sold to H-283. Next line.
The Ruby Slipper. What have you done with them? Give them back to me or I'll...
It's too late. There they are, and there they'll stay.
How much do I hear for the shoes? Started out, somebody, what will you give? There they are. $1,000, two. $2,000, I bid the shoes, three. $3,000, I bid the shoes, make it four. $4,000, $5,000, bid six. $6,000, I bid the shoes, now make it seven. $7,000, $10,000, bid the shoes, now make it 11. $11,000, bid now 12. $15,000, bid, we make it 20. $15,000, I bid once. $15,000, I bid twice. $15,000, I bid third and last call. Are you all through? Fair warning. And they are sold. The bidder's number, please.
$15,000 for the ruby slippers from the Wizard of Oz. Today, MGM's money is largely invested in two gigantic hotels, $125 million in the Las Vegas Grand and $200 million in the MGM Grand in Reno. 7 years ago, the once proud Tiffany of film studios stopped distributing, and its few current releases are distributed by others. This is the way a world ends, not with a lion's roar, but a whimper. On December 22, 1979, the executive president emeritus and co-founder of the 20th Century Fox Studios died. Darryl F. Zanuck was 78 years of age. He'd spent over 50 years in the industry, supervising some 1,500 productions, whilst personally producing another 50 films like How Green Was My Valley, Grapes of Wrath, The Snake Pit, Gentleman's Agreement, and The Longest Day. He was the last of the image makers, and what images they are that remain in the memory and on film. Marilyn Monroe, Betty Grable, Tyrone Power, Richard Widmark, Gregory Peck, Shirley Temple, and Rin Tin Tin. The stars have gone, but the films remain, and the studios. The rambling MGM studios with their historic sound stages are still standing idle, gathering dust. Other Hollywood studios have slashed wildly to cut losses. Paramount recently moved into an office block, and United Artists and American International rent the studio space they need. Columbia Pictures have merged with Warner Brothers and become the Burbank Studios, leaving Walt Disney, Universal, and 20th Century Fox with studios of their own. In Hollywood's cellar days, The film town turned out 600 pictures a year. The figure is now down to well below 200. Most of them are made everywhere else but in Southern California. The golden age of Hollywood has been a long time dying.
Who show up at this hour? It's time people went home. Hold that coat up. Who's it?
Some Hollywood movie star. Her plane got in late.
Discouraging, isn't it? Women with furs like that where it never even gets cold.
Hollywood.
Hooray for Hollywood. That's gooey, ballyhooly Hollywood. Where any office boy or young mechanic can be a panic with just a good-looking pan.
And any shop girl can be a top girl if she pleases the tired businessman.
Hooray for Hollywood. You may be homely in your neighborhood.
Be an actor, see Mr. Factor. You make your kisser look good.
Go out and try your luck. You may be Donald Duck. Hooray for Hollywood.
Hooray for Hollywood.
Hey, Benny.
Hi, Ronnie. Come on, fellas. Here, here.
Hooray for Hollywood.
They hire cowboys and they hang their shafts up and all their maps up and give them all that they lack. Now ain't it funny, they pay them money, shows what you can do if your horse can act.
Hooray for Hollywood. They hire fellas whose physiques are good and then they tell them they're the perfect shape men to act like ape men, and they convince them they should. They make them grunt and yell, oh, 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 oh.
And people think they're swell,
oh, 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 oh.
Hooray for Hollywood.
It's really got me. Hooray.
Hooray.
You've been listening to The Image Makers. I'm Laurie Bruce. This has been an ABC production by Jeff Dugan.